gasolina.
And welcome to Subject to Discussion. I'm Sean O'Mac, Sean Daly. Call me anything you want, just don't call me late for dinner. And for some reason the light's blinking already. I don't know, usually I don't get calls on this show, so it's a shock. But I do have a couple guests going to be coming on in just a few minutes. They're going to be on at the about 6:15 or 9:15 if you're on the East Coast, or 8:15 if you're in the Midwest. It's going to be Alan Stewart Carl and Joe Whedon. They're the bloggers behind the Yellow Line blog at theyellowline.blogspot.com. They're viewed as centrists. One of them is a former Democrat. The other one's a former Republican. So what does that make them? I don't know. And so they'll be on in just a few minutes. Both of them are based in Washington. And hear what they have to say about what's going on in the world and everything else. So, and like I said, this is Subject to Discussion. Heard every Wednesday on LVRocks.com at 6 o'clock Pacific. And adjust the time to your part of the country, or the world, as it were. And I'm Sean O'Mac. My email is seanomacradio@yahoo.com. And the website is subject2discussion.com. And the show is archived over with my good friends over at spankwagon.net. And it's coming soon. It's going to be archived over at the whiterose.org. So that's going to be interesting. And first of all, I'm going to start off the news a little bit. And I see Lil Bucks in the chat room. She was in the chat room last week under a different name. So, and I'm going to start off the news with this horrible story about the bombing in Iraq that happened today. This is from the Associated Press, and it's an Iraqi seen standing in line outside a police recruitment center with scores of job applicants blew himself up Wednesday, killing about 60 Iraqis and wounding 150 in the deadliest insurgent attack in more than 2 months, the United States military and Iraqi police said. And it keeps going on over there in Iraq. And then, of course, on Sunday we had a Iraqi car blast at funeral, leaves 25 dead. A car bomb obliterated a tent packed with mourners at the funeral of a Kurdish official in northern Iraq on Sunday, killing 25 people and wounding more than 50 in the single deadliest attack since insurgents started bearing down on Iraq's newly named government late last week. Well, that was before it happened today, of course. And what else? Then we had the insurgents strike again. This is from Friday. They strike across Iraq, killing 50 more. Insurgents set off at least 17 bombs in Iraq Friday, killing at least 50 people, including three U.S. soldiers, in a series of attacks aimed at shaking Iraq's newly formed government. An audio tape by one of America's most wanted insurgents, Abu Mossad al-Zarqawi, warned President Bush that there was more bloodshed to come. And then today we had the big news that al-Qaeda's number three man was arrested in Pakistan. Pakistani commandos nabbed former al-Qaeda leader, described by United States officials as the group's number three operative at a shootout in one of his Heartscrabble hideouts. What does that mean? Jubilant Pakistani officials said Wednesday his arrest would help in the hunt for Osama bin Laden. So let's hope so. I mean, that guy's been loose ever since 9/11, and we could find the guy who supposedly had a fling with Paul Abdul on an American Idol, but we can't find bin Laden. You know, it's amazing. Then we had also on Tuesday we had Joint Chiefs of Staff General Myers said that Iraq and Afghan wars strain the military. You know, it's like a light bulb going off in his head. No kidding. The United States military may not be able to win any new wars as quickly as planned because the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan have strained its manpower and resources. General Richard Myers, Joint Chiefs of Staff, described U.S. military as in a period of increased risk. We will prevail. The timelines may have to be extended. We may have to use additional resources, but it doesn't matter because we're going to be successful in the end. Among the most likely conflicts the Pentagon foresees in the future, in the near term, are with North Korea and Iran, the two remaining members of President Bush's axis of evil. 138,000 American troops are in Iraq, according to U.S. Central Command, and another 18,000 in Afghanistan. So, and then, of course, we had the big defense spending bill was approved, and it reached a record $82 billion measure. The House, and this is from PMS, NBC, no. Actually, that's going to be dropped. Microsoft is dropping out of MSNBC, so the MS is going to go away, and it'll be the NBC news channel. House and Senate negotiators agreed Tuesday on a measure that would provide $82 billion for Iraq and Afghanistan and a nearly tenfold increase in the death benefit for survivors of troops killed in combat zones, which is that's a good point, but, I mean, this money flying out the window, beyond $300 billion since 9/11. Most of the money is slated for military operations, nearly $1 billion more than what the president wanted. About $4.2 billion will be spent on foreign aid and other international relations relations programs in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. I saw something that was interesting. Let's see. They have this ID thing with the legislation also includes immigration revision provisions, including one that will make states verify that driver's license applicants are U.S. citizens or legal immigrants. And the death benefit is going to go for the survivors of the troops that get killed. The one-time benefit increases to $100,000 from the current $12,000 payout. And this money is just flying out the window. Where we got here? Oh, and also, this is interesting about Condoleezza Rice. On the foreign affairs side, Congress sliced several of Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, her requests. The measure provides $230 million for funds controlled by Rice, for United States allies in the war on terror, bribe money, and for economic and military aid. She had requested $400 million, so she's not getting everything she wanted. And the State Department also gets a little of this. I think they're building a Las Vegas casino in Baghdad because the State Department gets $592 million to build a sprawling embassy in Baghdad. And it's about $70 million less than what she wanted. So she wanted to build $662 million embassy, and that's going to have some slot machines in it. I think Stickman and Roy are going to be doing a show there. I mean, what the hell's going on over there? The State Department will also get $680 million for international peacekeeping efforts in countries including Sudan and Haiti. Let's see, $200 million for in economic and infrastructure assistance to the Palestinian Authority. Why are we forking out all this money? I mean, I don't understand this. Here's $635 million for increased U.S. border security, including money to hire another 500 Border Patrol agents. They better make that 5,000 more Border Patrol agents. And $858 million for tsunami disaster relief. Okay, what about the disaster relief in Florida from those people in the hurricanes? The people are still living in tents down there, and yet we're forking out money out to the Asian area. You know, we got people in tents. You know, we should send some money down there to our own people down there in Florida. Oh, well. And then also on Tuesday, here we go, about the Army knew details of Tillman's death. This is Army officials knew within days of Pat Tillman's death that the former NFL player had been killed by fellow Rangers during a patrol in Afghanistan, but then did not inform his family and the public for weeks. A new Army report shows that General B. Abizade, the theater commander in Afghanistan, and other top officials were aware an investigation had determined the death was caused by an act of gross negligence. 4 days before a nationally televised memorial service, what the hell? I mean, what's he doing still in there for? I mean, they should be trumping him out, I think. I mean, he knew that was friendly fire, yet they let it go on with this memorial service, and I think he's, he is a hero, but I mean, he died from friendly fire, not from enemy combat. Let's see. The Post reported on its online edition Tuesday that troops on the scene said they were immediately sure that Tillman was killed by a barrage of American bullets. And also we had this from the London Times. I didn't see this anywhere else, that Tony Blair, he's up for re-election as of yesterday and today, he was hit by a new leak of secret war plan. This is from the London Times. A secret document from the heart of government, from the heart of government reveals today that Tony Blair privately committed Britain to war with Iraq and then set out to lure Saddam Hussein into providing the legal justification. The Downing Street Minutes headed secret and strictly personal, UK eyes only. It's like James Bond. It was chaired by the Prime Minister. Blah, blah, blah. The document reveals Blair backed regime change by force from the outset, despite warnings from Lord Goldsmith, the Attorney General, that such action would be illegal. In the records, a meeting in July 2002 attended by military and intelligence chiefs at which Blair discussed military options, having already committed himself to supporting President George Bush's plan for ousting Saddam. A separate secret briefing for the meeting said Britain and America had to create conditions to justify a war. Anyway, he had not revealed to MPs or the public that in April 2002 he had told Bush the UK would support U.S. military action to bring about regime change. As recorded in the Foreign Office briefing paper, both before and after the July meeting, Blair insisted in public no decision had been made. So they already committed, to this war in Iraq, and then they didn't, it's crazy. They want to lure Saddam into this war. So they want a war. So they want to pull him into it. Amazing. Now we're hitting the United States. eyes, Indonesia and Vietnam as a political strategic allies in the Southeast Asia. Oh, well, that might be our guests coming on. The United States is eyeing Muslim giant Indonesia, an erstwhile enemy, Vietnam, as potential strategic allies in Southeast Asia as it moves to expand a counterintelligence drive and contain China's growth influence in the region. And as the President of the United States has three close allies in the region, treaty allies, the Philippines and Thailand, as well as key security partner Singapore. And what else? And President Bush is going to visit two Soviet republics. This is from today. President Bush is going to be side by side with Vladimir Putin at the next week's Red Square Parade, celebrating the 60th anniversary of the end of the World War II in Europe. Is meant to recall the great wartime alliance that defeated Nazi Germany. It's a coup for Putin, but Bush is making stops along the way to Moscow and back that are much less pleasing to the Russian leader. The president starts and ends a trip in ex-Soviet republics Latvia and Georgia. And, well, he's trying to, you know, kiss up to them and everything else. I wonder if they got oil over there. The president meets the press at a primetime news conference last week on Thursday, and President Bush had his first primetime press conference in months, tried to focus Thursday night on Social Security and energy prices, clearly conveying that he still planned to do something about each. He's got this progressive indexing plan for the Social Security where supposedly the least fortunate among us will get the most benefits and the most fortunate will get the least benefits. NBC, his press conference was end before the primetime lineups kicked in at 9 o'clock because they had May sweeps and the network said they want the President Bush interrupting their May sweeps. NBC and CBS cut away abruptly at the bewitching hour of 9 p.m. approached with two questions yet to come. So they cut them off because they had The Apprentice, I think Survivor, or The Simpsons Go to Paris or something was on Fox. He also showed that criticism of his refusal to ever admit a mistake hasn't gotten to him either. Asked if he contributed at all to the growing partisan divide in Washington, some people just don't like me, he said. Yeah. He says we're making real good progress in Iraq. Oh, you won't know that by the headlines the last 3 days. Despite General Richard Myers' report this week, the insurgency is as strong as ever. He described we are making progress. So, I mean, this is on and on and on. And Congress approves $2.6 trillion budget. This is from Reuters from Friday. It's going to budget plan $2.6 trillion that calls for new tax cuts and spending reductions over the next 5 years. Republicans in the House and the Senate pushed through the budget blueprint without a support of a single Democrat. Among the key components are proposals for up to $106 billion in additional tax cuts over 5 years, coupled with $35 billion in spending cuts. I mean, it's a little lopsided, I think. Shouldn't the spending cuts be as equal as the tax cuts if he's going to offer us that? Included in spending savings is a controversial plan to reduce the growth in funding for Medicaid, the health care plan program for the poor. The budget proposes $10 billion in savings over 4 years to the program that is run jointly by the states and the United States government. The Republican-controlled Congress failed last year to get a budget plan, making it harder to control spending that contributed to a record $412 billion budget deficit last year. And they're going to open up the Anwar for drilling, for oil. Never mind, we got this 18.4-cent federal gas tax that you could do away with. Some of this is just, and then Medicare, Social Security is a problem, but Medicare and Medicaid are worse problems, and he's addressing Social Security. He's ignoring the problem with Medicare and Medicaid. It's nuts. So, but anyway, I think we'll bring our guests on, huh? And we're joined by our guests from the yellowline.blogspot.com. Gentlemen, you there?
Yeah, we're here.
Hello. You there? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. And who's this I'm talking to?
This is Joe Whedon.
Alan's
here as well.
There you go. And this is Joe Whedon and Alan Stewart Carl. They're both the bloggers from the blog with it. yellowline.blogspot.com, correct?
That's right. You can also get us at yellowlineblog.com.
There you go. And you're both in Washington. I'm sorry to hear that.
No? Yeah, we both live in Washington, D.C.
Okay. And now, first of all, get the listeners out there a little background on your blog. How'd y'all manage to start your blog?
Well, I started the blog a few months ago when I became particularly disgusted with the tone in politics currently.
Okay.
I was a Democrat for many, many years and continued that trend until the Democratic Party just kept going further and further left. And once Howard Dean became the head of the DNC, I left the Democrats and decided instead of just sitting on the sidelines complaining, I would start a blog. And my good friend Joe, who was a Republican until very recently, agreed to join with me so that we could write about things from a centrist point of view.
Really? Now, what's the news on your blog right now? Let me pull it up. I think you had something about Kerry on there, right?
I think the most recent post was about John Kerry. The Hill had an article today about John Kerry's desire to run again in 2008 and how he's building an organization for it already. And our take on that is fairly similar to most people's take, which is John Kerry does not have much of a chance in 2008. I don't know if he's brave to be doing this or he's deluded to be doing this. But, you know, we welcome his candidacy because it gives everyone else that's going to run a chance to see what they need not to be. And we hope that actually moves the Democratic Party away from John Kerry and towards a more centrist viewpoint.
And now, Joe, you're a Republican. It should be high time for you, huh?
Well, like Alan, is a former Democrat. I'm a former Republican.
Okay.
I've been involved in party politics. I actually, on the periphery, worked on the Bush campaign in 2000. But in response to many of the, especially the recent events, I've grown disenchanted with the direction the party's going. And I think we also need to move towards the middle. We need to have real debate.
Yeah.
The ideologues that are in charge of running things, especially on the national level now, I can't say that I completely agree with.
Yeah. Now, how y'all getting along on your blog? I mean, do you ever find yourself at odds of what's going to get posted on the blog? Or
we haven't really yet.
No.
First, we tend to discuss anything that may be controversial that we may see differently as we, you know, before we put up the post. But at the same time, we're both, Alan's what we would call a Texas Democrat, I'm what you'd call an Illinois Republican. There's a good deal of overlap between our positions. On many issues, I'm more liberal than he is, on many he's more conservative than I am. So you take things one at a time. We have true bipartisan discussions on things. Where we agree, we disagree, and that will come out in the blog over time, but we haven't really gotten there yet.
Yeah, very good. I've been reading your blog. I mean, it's very well laid out. I mean, some of your ideas are, you know, are very good. I mean, it's not left, it's not right. It's like I said, it's in the center, which is I think where most of the country is anyway. I mean, we got a couple of issues that pull us left or right, but I think for the most part, we're all in the middle.
Right. Well, if you look at any of the studies now, there's 30% Republicans, 20% Democrats, the rest is in the middle. And
yeah.
I think that's where both Alan and I are, and that's obviously where most of America is.
Yeah. Now, what have been reactions from your, you know, you're in Washington. Now, do you work for on the Hill, or?
I do government affairs, government relations for a nonprofit trade association, nonprofit, nonpartisan.
Okay. Now, what's been your reaction to your blog so far? Have you gotten a lot of good, positive response? I know Joe Gandelman at the Moderate Voice, he can't speak higher of your blog there, so that's good respect from somebody like him.
We've actually gotten a lot of good response. A lot of the other people out there that are working for a centrist position, John Avalon, who a lot of people are familiar with, wrote Independent Nation, which had discussions with him, and we've heard from others that are very excited that there are more voices coming out that aren't idealistic but are from a reasonable centered position in politics.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people who read our blog are expecting us to be from the left or from the right. I think we've gotten criticism from both sides, but usually if we get criticism from both sides on one issue, we think we're doing a good job, because if you upset people on the far left and the far right, you're usually pretty center.
Yeah, that's what Joe said, too. If you people criticize him, he must be doing a good job, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then now, John Kerry, tell me about John Kerry now. What do you think about, you know, we're going into 2006, 2008. Now, you really, according to your blog, he seems to think, I got an article here today, he seems to think he's a shoo-in for the nomination, 08. I mean, what do you both think about that?
Well, I'm trying to think. Alan did that post today. I was out, and I haven't really seen a whole lot about the Hill story. We talked about it, obviously. I think he stands a good chance of getting the nomination because of his position moving forward, because of the infrastructure that he put together for the 04 campaign. A lot of politics today, unfortunately, is about positioning within the money elite, and about building an infrastructure and being able to develop a financial base. And John Kerry is leaps and bounds ahead of any other Democratic candidate right now. So he stands a very good position, or stands a very good chance of being in position to capture the nomination in another 3.5 years. But a lot's going to happen before then that's going to change that dynamic.
Very good.
According to the poll that they showed in Hill, he's already like 12 points behind Hillary Clinton among Democrats.
Yeah.
He's about 4 points ahead of John Edwards. So while he's positioning himself for a run, he hasn't positioned himself in the lead yet. And I really don't think he's going to get there. I think these days, if you lose an election like that, the party's not going to give you another chance to run for it.
Yeah, I mean, when he lost, I said, he should just go away. I mean, the Democrats especially, I mean, once you lose, you're a loser. I mean, we didn't see Dukakis again after his loss, and Carter was invisible after his loss. I mean, once you lose, you're labeled a loser, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, you haven't seen anyone run twice, mm-hmm. I don't think, since John Dewey. I don't think we're going to see it this time either. I think a lot of Kerry supporters came out of the whole situation a little tired and a little upset with his campaigning. And I think a lot of people gave their energy not towards John Kerry, but towards defeating George Bush.
Yeah.
And since George Bush isn't going to be running this time, I don't think Kerry has much going for him.
Yeah.
And if you look even further back, Al Gore and John Kerry, neither one did a great job of articulating a true vision for the Democratic Party, and I think the Democrats are going to look for somebody who can articulate a good, moderate vision, not the extreme views that Howard Dean is taking the party down, but a good presidential candidate that can bring the nation together and stand for something other than being against the Republicans that are in office now.
Yeah, the chairman's wanting each one of you to say your names before you start talking. I guess they have a hard time telling one from the other. But, I've said it before. As soon as Kerry lost, I said, in 2008, it's Hillary's to lose. I mean, don't you agree that it's Hillary or nothing in 08?
You know, I think there's more people out there than just Hillary. I don't
really
think a lot of people have heard of Bill Clinton 4 years before he had run.
Yeah.
There's a number of red state governors out there right now. Philip Redison of Tennessee is one that comes to mind that has managed to build a pretty good base of support in a state that constantly goes Republican on the national level, but has elected him twice to governorship of Tennessee. So there's figures out there like that might give Hillary a run for her money if the party decides they don't need another Northeast liberal on the ticket.
Hmm. You think she will play to the Northeast more? I don't know. I mean, she's more of a national figure, I thought. I mean, she's got the Arkansas connection, and, you know, granted she's a senator from New York, but I think she's got more of a national, you know, she's a lightning rod, too, but, I mean,
she's from Illinois, and, you know,
true.
She's from Arkansas, and she's from New York, so I'm sure she can position herself as from just about any state.
Yeah.
But she does have the image of being a liberal. Now, she's been trying to position herself in the center recently. Whether that's going to fly with the electorate or not remains to be seen.
Yeah. Well, and who else is that? Well, I know they said that the governor from Warner from, was he from Virginia? They said he might be a possible candidate. He's like a Clinton light. And what do you think about him?
Governor Warner is a fairly moderate, he hasn't taken positions yet within the state of Virginia that are going to draw the liberals of the party to him.
Mm-hmm.
So from that perspective, he's well-positioned. He's a Southern Democrat, a lot of money. He can self-finance to a certain extent. He stands a good shot of at least being a voice in the debate as we begin the process of determining who the Democrats are going to run against whoever the Republicans are going to run. We're just a long way away from the 2008 primaries to start talking specifically about who's going to run and who's not going to run. You could also throw in the names of Governor Bill Feck in Iowa, the governor out in Arizona, the very moderate female who has done a good job of reaching across the aisle and building bipartisan support for a lot of her initiatives.
Yeah.
There's also Governor Blagojevich in Illinois who has presidential ambitions, who's done a pretty good job of reaching across the aisle. So there's a lot of names that could come up and could come out in the next 2 years that stand a good shot of being able to at least be a voice in the debate as we begin the 2008 election cycle.
Yeah. Now, what do you think of this, the new Social Security plan that President Bush announced, the indexing? He's going to progressively index, he wants to, I don't know if he's going to get away with it or not, but progressively index Social Security from the poorest among us, to the more, well, according to him, though, you're well off if you make, $20,000 a year, so I don't know where he's getting that at, but, we'll index it. What do you think of that plan?
Well, the indexing is an interesting add-on to the privatization idea. The problem is that privatization is in no way going to fix the shortfalls that are coming up in Social Security. Joe and I have talked about this on a number of occasions. When you actually get into the policy behind Social Security, it's a fairly complex issue. Right now, I don't think we've had a debate at all in this country about the future of Social Security. And I think we need to have a debate, but right now, I think the Democrats are in a strong position because polls show that a majority of Americans are not in favor of Bush's plan. So they can just sit back and oppose without coming up with any new ideas. Bush, on the other hand, is obviously struggling to sell his idea, and I think he threw in this indexing as kind of a nod to those who are afraid that his plan would hurt the lower income earners. I don't think his plan is going to fly. I don't think it's going to get through the Senate, but I wouldn't be opposed personally to talking about benefit cuts for the upper middle and upper classes. I don't know if we as a society have a responsibility to give people money who already can afford to live their retirement well. But I think that's a separate issue from the privatization issue.
Well, do you think I don't think that privatization is going to fly at all either. I mean, the Democrats are digging in on that issue. I don't think they're going to let that go.
Yeah, and here's what I keep thinking about the whole privatization issue. To me, it makes some sense to force me to pay money for the generation that came before. I mean, after all, they left us with a pretty good America. We don't want them to live their retirement out in poverty. So there's some sense in that. I don't quite understand why the government wants to force me to save money. If they want to give me the opportunity to save money tax-free, you know, no taxes going in, no taxes coming out, I probably can support that. But forcing me to have a retirement account on their plan, I'm not sure that's the social policy we really need in this country.
Now, what about the Medicare problem? Everybody's saying that's a worse problem than Social Security, and Bush is purposely ignoring that to try and tackle Social Security. Now, I've seen everything saying that Medicaid is worse off than Social Security.
Yeah, Medicaid and Medicare are in bad situation, but that's just one part of the entire healthcare system, which is in bad situation right now. And unfortunately, no one is addressing that in a substantive way. It's as if after Bill Clinton and Hillary tried to fix it, after that, it's been pretty much forgotten to try to do anything substantive to fix it.
Yeah, I mean, I just, especially the filibuster. Well, how's the filibuster playing, the business about the filibuster playing in Washington? They're ready for, like, a nuclear winter back there?
That's certainly the rumor that's going around town right now. There's a lot of support on the Republican side to send a message to the Democrats that they're able and still willing to play hardball on this issue, that every individual who is nominated for a federal position deserves an up or down vote by the full Senate. The Democrats have stood their ground, and you've got to respect them for that, saying that the Republicans have been as obstructionist as Democrats are being now. So there's a lot of rhetoric going around right now. Who knows whether or not either side is really going to hold their guns on this, because quite frankly, in a year or 2 years after the 06 election, after the 08 election, the Republicans could be the minority party in the Senate. And this could come back to hurt the minority party in the Senate in the future, whether it's Republicans or Democrats. I don't think it's a good option. It's partisan. It's partisan-driven. It's not about good politics. It's not about what's right for this country.
Yeah, as I keep saying, there's a lot of issues facing this country. Yet we're all off in this filibuster business, and that all that Schiavo mess and everything else. And we got Social Security is a problem, Medicare is a problem. We got the deficits are soaring. Not to mention the gas prices. I mean, I don't know why they can't just realize there's problems down here with the Joe Q public. You know what I mean?
Well, Well, one of the latest compromises that Senator Frist has floated to end the stalemate and actually move towards votes on some of the judicial nominees is the idea of floating or giving Democrats 100 hours to debate the current judicial nominees. 100 hours of Senate time is a lot of Senate time. If you look at the calendar, the amount of days that the Senate is actually in Senate debating actual politics, I don't remember off the top of my head what percentage, but it's a substantial portion of the time that's left for the end of, for the rest of this congressional session. And that's almost enough to prevent something such as Social Security reform, the energy bill, from getting the debate it deserves.
Yeah, I mean, some of this is, you know, how's the price of gas back there?
$1.20, $1.30 a gallon.
What, you mean two? Or one? A dollar?
No, come on. I filled up today and it was $2.22.
There you go.
Okay, I haven't been to the gas station in a few days.
Wow. So what do you do, riding a bike or rowing a boat or something, huh? No? But, I mean, the gas problem, that's a huge problem in this country. I saw there was a report here the other day that we probably won't see the price of gas fall below $2 a gallon ever again.
Yeah, I mean, that's what a lot of people are saying, that we've pretty much hit a permanent place here in the gas prices where we're just going to have to expect to pay more money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the positive side of that is it could influence the automakers to start making more fuel-efficient cars.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I haven't really seen the numbers yet, but I'm willing to bet that SUV sales are suffering. Mm-hmm. Under gas prices this high. So if gas prices are going to stay high, maybe it can push us towards coming up with some energy-saving solutions.
Right. There's no short-term solution to the gas crisis or gas price crisis that's out there right now.
Mm-hmm.
Simply put, the U.S. doesn't have the refining capacity and the world doesn't have the refining capacity to produce more gas. Whether or not we drill in Anwar, whether or not we import more oil, we don't have the capacity to refine it and turn it into the types of fuels that we use today. It'll take 5 to 10 years to build the refineries that we would need. So the solution's not producing more gas. The solution is being smarter and consuming less, especially when you're talking in the global market, when you've got India and China with vastly expanding energy consumption and energy needs, there's not enough supply to meet current demand, so you're going to see prices go up.
Yeah.
Capitalism at its finest.
True, and then China is consuming more gas, too, and then, of course, then we got the strategic oil preserver, you know, putting in, what, 500,000 barrels a day into that.
Right.
And which I think, so we got this 18-cent federal gas tax. I keep saying Bush can get eliminate that, at least temporarily, at least to give us some relief. But, I mean, that's only a short-term fix for a long-term problem.
Yeah, the problem with removing the gas prices is that, I mean, the rules of capitalism are the prices will raise what the market can bear.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see that eaten up almost immediately, and instead of it going towards, you know, paying for highways, the money would just go in straight into the pockets of the gas company.
Yeah.
Right. The 18 cents gas tax can be better spent by investing in mass transit, investing in rail options, ensuring that when we pass the energy bill that there are true incentives for the automakers in this country to develop energy-efficient automobiles, something that gets more than the 13 miles in a gallon the SUVs get, something that gets more than the 8 or 9 miles a gallon the Hummers get.
Yeah, I mean, it's to understand. I remember when Carter was in, and I think he had a program set in place where after so many years, the automakers would have to have their cars at, I thought it was 30 miles a gallon, and all that went away. And I don't know what happened to that. I wish they'd go back to make these automakers make their cars more fuel efficient, maybe in stages, not all at once, but in stages.
Yeah, it would be nice if there were stricter regulations on that, but I don't necessarily know that we need them. I think you will see, as you know, fuel prices rise, that automakers are going to have to increase their fuel efficiency. The only reason that their SUVs out there getting 9 miles a gallon is because they don't have to invest in making it do more, because gas has been so cheap that people can afford it. As soon as people are paying over $50 for a tank of gas, they're not going to want to drive those SUVs anymore. I mean, you're going to see the sales of fuel-efficient cars go up. There's already one coming out by a Lexus SUV coming out that you can't get because the whole list has been reserved already.
Wow. Wow, wow. Well, I know, and a lot of these cars coming in from, I think the Toyotas and whatever it was, they're like the fuel, what we call the hybrids, and those are outnumbering the, you know, the American cars, because we're not even making hybrids over here. You know?
Yes, the Toyota Prius has been a very, been sold very well, particularly out in California, where, of course, they have very high fuel efficiency standards. So I don't know how many people are going to choose themselves to go out and buy one of these, or how many people are going to have to buy one when the automakers, that's what they're having to make, just pay to sell their cars.
True.
Right. And Toyota was supposed to come out with a couple of new models of the hybrid in 2005. I know the Highlander was one of those. And they've had to put back production a little bit because they weren't willing to release the car models until they were able to adequately meet demand for the new models coming out. So there is a demand out there. They just don't have the production capacity yet to meet that demand.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of time before we go down that road, but it's going to take some time.
Yeah. Now, I want to touch on somebody messaged me about the news conference that President Bush had. What did you think of that? Whoever wants to.
On the Social Security debate?
Well, the whole thing, the whole press conference, because he's done hardly any primetime news conferences. It was a little odd. He came out last Thursday for a primetime news conference.
Right.
You know,
one of the things, if you look at American politics today, look at the local news coverage, you get a 6 to 9 second soundbite in most things, and that's quite frankly enough to sell a policy to most of America. You don't see a lot of coverage today of people sitting down and watching an hour press conference. Two of the four networks tuned out at 9 o'clock, or at 9 o'clock, an hour after he started East Coast time, to get to Survivor, to get to The Apprentice, because those are the things that drive revenue. The American public just, quite frankly, isn't interested in many cases in having a true debate. They've already made up their mind on the positions based on what they've heard from CNN or their local news in the 6 to 9 seconds that they hear.
Which is a shame.
Yeah, I don't really think it's that America's not interested in having the debate. I think it's that the people in power are interested in keeping the debate as short as possible. They're not really interested in thinking about the issue so much as they are selling the issue. And I think that a lot of the problems with politics today is that instead of going out and actually conversing with the American people, you have what Bush has been doing, which is going out and filling his town hall to people who already agree with him.
Mm.
But that's not a town hall. I mean, a town hall should be a discussion between the people and their elected officials about the policy, not just, you know, a rally in favor of a specific policy.
True, true. And once again, I'm Sean O'Max. This is Subject to Discussion. I'm joined by Alan and Joe. They're from the Yellow Line blog, which is a centrist blog. And I have a question from the chat room. Op is asking, what third party has the best potential to make a decent showing in the federal elections? And what do they have to do to get there? I don't know. I think you had a post in there. It's almost impossible for a third party to go anywhere because of the electoral system, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's not impossible for a third party to rise up, but it's going to be very difficult for one, particularly a third party presidential candidate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there has not been a third party that has shown up in a strong way since the Republicans came on board back in the 1850s.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking a long time since one, and we did write an entire post about how the Electoral College is pretty much against any third party candidate. You'd have to win more than just a plurality of the popular votes. You'd actually have to win half of the electoral votes. You'd have to win how many states you need to win to get the presidency. And most likely, even if you do win several states, all that you'll end up doing is causing the election to get thrown into the House, which I don't think anyone's going to be happy with.
No. I mean, I just don't see, unless, because the Electoral College is a constitutional provision. I mean, that's going to take an act of biblical proportions almost to get that changed, correct?
Yeah, I mean, they would take a constitutional amendment to change the Electoral College the way it is today, which is why that from our position, we're not really looking for a third-party insurgency. We're looking for an insurgency inside both the parties to bring them both back to reasonable dialogue with each other. We have no problem with people disagreeing on issues. What we have a problem is that people being ideological about it and partisan about it, where their side says, this is our support, and they just stick behind it. I mean, we talk a lot about spin today, and I define spin as when someone disagrees with positions but goes ahead and supports it anyways. that spin, and so many people are forced to do that because of the way the current parties work. Mm-hmm. And I really think we need to work with both parties and inside both parties to get them back to having reasonable debates with one another.
That's true. Because I've been a Democrat, and out here in Vegas, I helped the Reform Party in the United States of America get going. And just, unless you, like Perot, he had all that money in the world. He only got, 19% of the vote the first time around, correct? And I think, less the second time around when he ran. Right?
Yeah, and much less the second time around. He didn't win a single state. So, mm-hmm. And then he's the most successful third-party candidate we've had.
Yeah, unless you have the Perot kind of money with some presidential charisma, I don't think these other third parties have stand a chance. Yeah, maybe they could influence the conversation, but I don't think they're going to have anybody elected president.
And that's what third parties have been doing since 1850, is influencing the conversation. I mean, you look at the Prohibition Party, had a huge success, obviously, when they got Prohibition put into the Constitution. But after that, they died off. They never had any major political victories in terms of getting people elected, but they did really influence the conversation.
Yeah.
I don't know, though, that a centrist party is going to be able to influence the conversation. I mean, a lot of these are one-issue parties that do it.
Yeah.
I mean, centrism isn't one issue. It's every issue. It's the way of thinking, not just policy positions.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like when Perot was starting with the United States Stand, he focused attention on the deficits and everything, which was good because they got the two camps. Who was it? It was Bush and Clinton to discuss the deficit, which is good. And Clinton actually accomplished something with the deficit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Perot did obviously had a major effect on both parties and on that election.
Yeah. And then, of course, then he ran all those infomercials, which kind of redefined political campaigning to this day. Correct?
Well, if you look at the history of partisan politics in this country, you'll see that in the 50s, 60s, 70s, up till Reagan, the Republican Party was actually much more moderate than it is today. Reagan was the first Republican to embrace the social conservatives, and since that time, you've got the Pat Robertsons of the party and other conservative leaders who have, Newt Gingrich comes to mind, who have moved the party further and further to the right. Mm-hmm. That voice has been the dominant voice in the Republican circles. And the Democrats today, you have Howard Dean as one of the dominant voices in the Democratic circles. Mm-hmm. So you've got polarizing figures, polarizing voices within the parties controlling the debate. What we need is a third party movement or a centrist movement that can appeal to elements of both parties and move parties back towards the middle. As I said before, we're 50% of the population here sitting in the middle that nobody's really representing. If somebody can appeal to us, they can build sizable majorities and control Congress and the government for years. Yeah. They just need to see that we care about the issues, that we take firm stands, and that we stand for something, and that we're not going to let the two extreme wings control America.
That's true. That's true. It's like myself, I believe in a strong military, and also I'm a social liberal. So I kind of get pulled both ways. Yeah, I guess I'm what they call a Roosevelt Democrat. But I mean, like Hillary, she's moving herself more to the center as well. She's moderating her tone, and then that's what she's got to do to get the nomination. She's got to move to the center. Correct.
Yeah, a lot of people say that to get the nomination, you have to move to the edges, and then to win the national election, you have to run to the center.
Mm.
It'll be interesting to see if it plays differently. I mean, just the other day, Pat Robertson, who I don't generally listen to, but he did say that he would support Rudy Giuliani if he got the nomination, which is interesting because Giuliani is a pro-choice Republican, and obviously Pat Robertson is not.
So. Yeah, I saw that. I couldn't believe Robertson said that. I fell off my chair when I saw that.
Yes, of course, this was also in the same interview in which he said that our federal judges are a greater threat than Al-Qaeda is, so you kind of have to take his words not at full value.
Yeah, that was unbelievable. I couldn't believe, and I expected the media to be jumping all over him on that because acquainting the judges with Al-Qaeda is just, nuts.
Yeah, there's been some coverage of it, but I mean, that's just the tone of politics right now. We've already had entire groups come out and say that people who support the filibuster are against people of faith, which is obviously ridiculous.
I mean,
there's people on faith on both sides of the issue. But, I mean, you also have on the other side, you have Howard Dean, who regularly says he hates Republicans. I don't think that's going to build too many bridges. I mean, there's a lot of good Republicans out there that aren't, for the extremism in their own party, and to demean them is not going to help the issue.
True. Now, what do you think of the approval ratings for Bush of the last current three two-term presidencies? 45% approval ratings. Clinton was at 59, and Reagan was at 56% in the second term. And keep in mind, Clinton was involved. The second term was Monica Lewinsky. So, what do you think of Bush's approval ratings falling?
I would think that most of his approval rate has fallen due to the Social Security debate. I mean, he came out of the gate thinking he could really just control the debate in America, and he did not. His people did not do a great job positioning that. I think they thought there was a lot more support for privatizing Social Security than they found out there. I think most Americans were taken by surprise by the whole plan. I think his falling approval rating is directly tied to that. And if you look at the polls for Social Security, it's not promising for the White House right now.
Even on a little bit of a bigger issue, if you look more in depth at some of the polls, Bush still enjoys a very strong approval from his base. And the Bush White House, under the leadership of Karl Rove, got him elected twice by appealing to his base and ensuring that he had very strong, very loyal following from a core element of the Republican Party. And he's been able to cement that, but at the expense of that, he is losing the moderate voice. He is losing the 50% in the middle that Alan and I and the others out there who are centrist are trying to represent. And he's creating an opening for somebody else to step into that sphere, into that area. And we're just looking for the next leader who's willing to do that.
Who do you think it's going to be? You think it's going to be, they said George Allen, perhaps, senator from, where's he from? Virginia, right? He used to be the governor.
Yeah, I mean, I think right now, in most centrist circles, I mean, you hear the name John McCain a lot, obviously. I mean, his candidacy back in 2000 really energized a lot of people that hadn't been energized before. Unfortunately, because he was running as a Republican, he got trampled by the social conservatives.
Hmm. Now, do you think would they nominate him? Because he's another one. He's pro-abortion and pro women's rights, everything else. I do really think
he's actually pro-life.
Pro-life, yes. Oh, he is.
Yeah,
okay, I thought
he's
pro-choice.
He is, but he isn't strongly pro-life in the sense that he's pro-life in the sense that he thinks that abortion is wrong, but he hasn't. He's not one of the people who goes out there and supports changing the Constitution. So. He's managed to keep that part of his beliefs really out of his whole persona, although he is pro-life. And, I mean, I think the greatest problem he's going to run into is his age.
Yeah, he'll be 74.
He's getting a little old to be running for president. Mm. I think 2000 probably was his best shot, but we'll see. I mean, rumors are that he's going to run again, and that would be a very interesting candidacy if he does.
Yeah, I'm saying that the Republicans got to come out with somebody strong because I don't think it's going to be Giuliani because I don't think the country is going to elect somebody. I hate to sound whittle it down to the smallest point, but a person named Rudy at all, and he's got the comb over, and then he got Pataki, looks like Principal Belding from Saved by the Bell, and then he got all these other people. I just don't think the American people are going to vote for people like that. You know what I mean? It's all vision.
It's interesting to see how Giuliani plays. I mean, right now in preliminary polls, and of course these are really preliminary polls, and you have to remember that a lot of this is based off name recognition, but. If you have Senator Frist, Senator Santorum, and then Rudy Giuliani, the only one who is currently beating Hillary is Giuliani. Again, I don't think a lot of people know much about him other than his performance after September 11th, which was very commendable, and I mean, he showed himself to be a very strong leader at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Whether he can move himself out of the politics of New York City and into the national scene remains to be seen.
I don't see it. Well, he got wounded over that Bernard Kerik business too, because he pretty much forced him on Bush to make him the Homeland Security chief. That kind of hurt Giuliani, I think. And then Frist, I don't see that either. I mean, he looks like Fred Rogers. You know what I mean? I mean, some of it's just visionary. You got to look presidential to be president. And right now, it's like Hillary's the number one choice. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I still think it's probably more likely that America votes for a man named Rudy with a comb over than elects a woman president.
You think so? I don't know. I mean, he's an entity. He's a New York East Coast politician, so I don't think...
I mean, I would like to think that the fact that, Hillary is a woman would not influence the voters, but, we have to be realistic. It's going to influence a certain number of voters.
Oh, absolutely. I think they'll come out of the woodwork to vote for her, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, yeah, both ways. Like I said, she's a lightning rod. She'll rile up the conservatives. It just all depends who gets out the most votes. If it's going to be the Democrats and the women or the conservatives with the anti-Hillary bloc. You know what I'm saying?
And as a centrist, that's one of the more disturbing things about a Hillary nomination is that she's a very polarizing figure, and it's not going to do wonders for the debate in this country to have her running for president. Now, if she can successfully position herself as a centrist, that's great, but I think she's going to have a hard time getting over her liberal past.
True. What about Governor Richardson from New Mexico?
He's an interesting figure. Mm. I mean, he's Hispanic, for one, which would definitely help the Democrats win some of the votes they've lost there. He's also fairly moderate.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be interesting. I'm not sure if he's going to be running or not, but it'll be interesting to see.
Unless he's on the ticket with somebody and it helps balance out the ticket a little bit, I mean, that might be an interesting VP choice for anybody who's on there, Edwards or Clinton.
I mean, he's definitely been a party loyalist, so he's not going to have a problem there.
Yeah.
He could end up being a VP candidate. I mean, right now, I mean, who knows who VP is going to be. If they're going to go the way that John Kerry went with someone that's going to add charisma to the ticket, or if they go the way that Bush went to try to add someone with experience to the ticket.
Yeah. I mean, do you see any third parties in 08? Anybody running? I doubt if Nader's going to run again. I mean, anybody out there do you think might just...
Even if Nader does run again, I mean, I don't think he's going to have any impact. He hardly had any impact last time.
Mm-hmm.
In 2000, his impact was actually, he only won like 3.5% of the vote. It just happened that the vote was so close in Florida that you could blame it on him. Right now, it doesn't look like there's going to be any third party independent candidate that comes up, but you never know. I mean, Ross Perot, I don't think, was considering running 4 years before he did, so there could be someone. I mean, there's rumors that John McCain might pair up with Bob Kerry and then running as an independent. That would be an interesting
thing.
Right. When you look at the primary system and the way that that politics in our country works, there's certainly a huge incentive for candidates, especially early in the process, to appeal to the base, to move to the side. And that creates an opening for a Ross Perot type, somebody to step up and step into that vacuum and help shape the debate. It's just really early to know who that's going to be. We haven't even gotten to the midterm elections to see how that's going to play out.
That's true.
So there's a lot of possibilities out there. It's just, at this point, it's really tough to say.
Well, gentlemen, we're going to have to let you go. We're almost at the end of the show, so I want to thank you both for coming on.
Thank you very much.
Alan and Joe.
Yes, thank you, Sean.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And that was Alan and Joe from the Yellow Line blog at yellowline.blogspot.com. One of them had a horrendous cell phone connection, but we got the other one in pretty well. But anyway, like I said, I see it's Hillary or nothing in 08 now, because the Republicans got to put up somebody. George Allen is a former governor, maybe, but he's a senator, and like they did with Kerry, he's got a record, and they could beat him over the head with this record like they did with Kerry. And he got that nut out there that started the anti-Hillary website, Finkelstein. I had the article here. Our website is like Stop Hillary Now or something like that. He's trying to slow her down from not winning her re-election in 06, thinking it'll slow her down, to stop her from running for president in 08. But I don't see the New Yorkers throwing her out of office. I mean, she's she's been moderating her stands on everything, and I personally, it'd be a great thing for this country to have her, a woman elected president, because that'll open the door for a Hispanic man, African American man. I mean, it's about damn time in this country. You know, if Battlestar Galactica can have a woman president of the damned remaining colonies, we could have a president of the United States here. So, why not a female UN Secretary General? I'm all for that. But I mean, I just And it's actually, Clinton said years ago, I remember that, because I worked on his campaign, he goes, to live like a Republican, you have to have a Democrat in the White House. So it's resonating true, isn't it? Hello, you better off now than you were 4 years ago? I don't think so. What were you paying for gas 4 years ago? We're $300 billion in a hole in Iraq. We could use that money for schools. We could use that money for fixing up Social Security, energy programs. We could use it for everything. We got $300 billion down the toilet in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the debts are running, shooting through the roof. Social Security is is in trouble. Medicare, Medicaid's in trouble. 4 years ago, whatever the hell it was when Bush came in, we had surpluses as far as the eye can see, and now we went from projected surpluses of like $2 to $3 trillion in 10 years to now we have a $4 trillion debt, $8 trillion. What happened to all that money? And I saw a report where they can't account for some of the money that they did send to Iraq, 100-something million they can't account for. I mean, this Iraq business is just going nuts. And that's a topic for another program because I'm almost out of time. But I do want to thank the guys for stopping by on the show this week. And next week's going to be Eric from the Move Left site. He's going to be with us to talk about what's going on, his point of view and everything. And hopefully, I got a good reaction from the last week's show with Crooks and Liars. So I want to thank everybody for listening to that. And also for Koenig Rules from our Galactica update. He'll be back next week for a Galactica update. He's a reliable one, so I can count him showing up. And I want to thank Little Buck for being in the chat room, and also Op. He's a Reform Party candidate. I believe he's running for office. I lost his website there. But and we wish him well. I said I used to work for the Reform Party, and I also used to work for the United We Stand America. And I like the third parties. They don't stand a chance like anybody president, but they can influence the discussion like Perot did with the Reform Party. He focused attention back on the debt and the deficit and everything else, and accountability, government accountability. We need to go back to that. Get these third parties railing against the establishment about the deficits and accountability for the government, and maybe these guys will wake up and pay attention. Because right now, where we're going, we're going to see, I hope not, we're going to see less voters turn out because people are so sick of this fighting over this stupid stuff with the filibuster and Chavo and all this nonsense. Let's get on the topic at hand here. We got problems coming out of our ears. We got troops dying left and right over in Iraq, 1,592, and we got thousands injured. We got money flying out the window for all this stuff.
Close the borders.
That's right. Well, they are going to finish the fence, supposedly. They're building a fence between California and Mexico.
Did you see, you're in
California?
Yeah, did you see the billboard wars?
Yeah.
We were talking about that earlier on the show.
He's another one.
Did you see the billboard?
They're letting him have it finally. He never should have been elected governor in the first place.
Did you see the billboard?
Yes, yeah.
Where it says Los Angeles, CA, and they cross the sea. Isn't that crazy?
But he never should have been elected governor in the first place.
No.
There should be no recall. The recall that we have is at the ballot box when they're up for re-election.
I wanted Arnold.
Nonsense. They wasted $60 million.
I want the other Arnold.
Which one? Arnold?
Gary Coleman. Arnold. What you talking about, Lewis?
Or that hooker, or that prostitute. She should have been governor.
Well, at least she would have been a hot, hottie.
Something to look at. They're not going to resolve anything in California. That's a state that I don't know what happened over. I keep saying, why don't they divide California?
Let's just give it to Mexico. There's a bunch of wackos out there, anyways.
They should divide California into three states because that state is too damn big.
Hey, look at this way. What? Then we'll be the border. Well, at least state line will be the border.
We don't want to be the border. We have to have more fences up there. And the Minutemen will have to come down there now.
Oh, great.
Anyway, Sabloft is next with the Power Hour. Thursday is Spank Wagon from 6 to 8. And then Friday. And then also, I moved the shows around. Well, hell, you're in charge now. You can move all the shows around. And then after that is King Hesh.
To say, your show is canceled.
Man, this is Emmy Award-winning program. Anyway, nobody's listening, but I win the awards anyway. And a futility award. And then Sunday is Tap Out, and I don't know what's next. And
email.
Sean O'Mac Radio at yahoo.com, and all next week is a guest host Arama on Daily Noise, right? Right?
What?
Guest host Arama on Daily Noise, right? You have a guest host Arama?
All week.
All week on Daily Noise. Anyway, good night. Have a pleasant tomorrow. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for Bob Lofton. Bye.